This is going to be short and sweet so that we can jump right into this hour plus episode with Karen BK Chan. I am getting ready to create a couple of online courses and webinars. Some of them will be free. Some of them will be very low cost to make them as accessible as possible with replays available. But I need to know from you, if I could teach you about anything, what would it be? I want to hear from you. So tweet at Sex Gets Real and let me know what kind of lesson you would love to see from me. Do you want to learn about anatomy in a super geeky way, or blowjobs, or kink, or anal sex, or communication techniques that make talking about sex easier? Anything and everything goes, but I want to hear from you what you would absolutely love to sign up for if I were teaching it. So pop over to Twitter, at Sex Gets Real. You can also go to Facebook on the Sex Gets Real page and leave a little note on the wall letting me know what you would love to see me teach, what you're so eager to learn about, and I want to make that happen for you. On with the show. Hey everyone, it's Dawn Sarah with Sex Gets Real, and on the line with me right now is someone who I completely adore. She was part of the Explore More Summit and was actually one of the most loved talks from everyone who listened to the summit. And I think you'll find out why very quickly. So I'd love to welcome you to the show, Karen BK Chan. Hi.
Hi, Dawn. You're also someone I adore. So that makes this conversation very nice.
Yes, we can just be super awesome together. So for those of you that don't know BK, I'm going to tell you a little bit about her, and we are going to have what I suspect is going to be just a delicious conversation. I have so many things I want to talk to you about, and then we have some listener questions that hopefully we'll have time for, so we'll see where we go. But Karen BK Chan, for those of you who are new to her work, is a sex and emotional literacy educator in Toronto, Canada. BK has taught and written about sex, sexuality, and emotional intelligence for over 18 years. She's dedicated to having conversations about sexuality that are real, transformative, and kind. I love that you say kind in your bio about talking about sexuality. I think that's so important.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of my favorite quotes that I just came upon last week that has described the last, let's say, 20 years is that when I was young, I used to admire clever people. And now that I'm old, I admire kind people. And I don't particularly identify as old, but it feels like that evolution is important.
Yeah. I agree. That's actually one of the things that I wanted to do when I very first started this podcast 2.5 years ago, was I felt like there was a lot of sex advice in podcast land from people who had very strong opinions, often to the point of being really cruel or judgmental. And I really felt like this space needed some more empathy and kindness in the advice realm. And it's something that I've just tried to do. And I think that's one of the things that comes across in your work so much, is just empathy and kindness. And I think that's just such a beautiful way to draw people in and to help people open.
Thank you. Likewise. Absolutely. Likewise.
So I know one of the things that you talk about a lot and you go to college campuses and talk about is consent and sexual communication. What's kind of your draw in talking about those topics? Like, why is that something that you're passionate about and that you love presenting over and over and over again?
Well, part of the draw is that it's being talked about a lot. And as with many things, it's when I'm not really feeling like I'm in the flow with the mainstream flow, that I feel like, okay, now I'm going to say something. I really appreciate a lot of the fervor around sexual consent and how I do feel like we're a part of a time that's changing, where norms are changing, where expectations are changing, where how we treat survivors is slowly changing. At the same time, I don't know if consent education itself has gotten to a place where it's actually really doing what it's supposed to do, that it's helping people feeling empowered to practice consent, to experiment with consent, to give and receive and not give consent. So it's actually out of some dissatisfaction that draws me. And my dissatisfaction comes from how often consent education comes from a place of rules and policy and don't do this or else you'll get in trouble, or don't do this, it's against the law. So it feels like very sort of the step that like one would take in the beginning of feeling empowered, like, no, you can't do this to me anymore. No, you can't take this for granted anymore. But my dissatisfaction comes from the place where that's a nice place for people who've been disempowered to get to, but that's not the actual place where potential perpetrators, potential people who might violate other people's consent could actually hear the message.
That's really powerful. So it sounds like part of why you want to have these conversations the way that you have them is to not only help empower people who feel like they don't have power or agency, but it's also to speak to the people who may be doing things that end up being abusive or traumatic, so that they can have a different perspective or a different vocabulary around this.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like sometimes in our excitement, our empowerment to say how wrong it is to take agency away from someone, to be entitled to their bodies, to actually physically and emotionally and mentally and spiritually hurt someone, perpetrators, violators, offenders become that basically we have to really make the act of that violation so evil, because we're trying to say this is very bad. Mm-hmm. But in the act of doing that, we make perpetrators and violators evil. And by doing that, we actually are alienating people from identifying themselves as possibly those violators. So I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but the message that we give is like, don't be evil. Mm-hmm. And most people can look you in the eye and say, I'm really, truly not evil. And so then the messages are for someone else. They're for really bad people. They're not for me. And I'm hoping that the conversation can widen so that we can all see that for a myriad of reasons, we are all sometimes tempted to, or inadvertently, or even purposefully and consciously violate other people's boundaries. That's much more likely to lead to actually a change in behavior when I can acknowledge that I might be that person.
That's really, really interesting. And I'm so happy to hear you say that, because I just had this really interesting experience. I was an observer of it in a session on embodied consent at the Woodhull Sexual Freedom Summit. Mm-hmm. And we had had this very rich discussion about embodied consent and kind of like rape culture and toxic masculinity and, empowering people to learn what it feels like to be embodied in your yes and your no. And this comment was made by one of the speakers that said, you know, one of the things you can do is kind of go in with a plan. If you feel like you're not good at saying no in the moment, then perhaps one of your plan items might be, if I'm unsure, I'll excuse myself to get a glass of water. Mm-hmm. And this cis white gentleman in the back, raised his hand. And I thought that he shared something really brave in a room that was primarily cis women and queer folks. And he said, you know, 20 years ago, me would have seen someone excusing themselves to get a glass of water as, oh, she wants me to keep doing this sexual thing. She's just thirsty. So when she gets back, we'll continue. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a really, really interesting share and a vulnerable share on his part to admit that there was a time in his life when he just would have assumed the activity is going to continue exactly as it's been. This person just needs a glass of water, instead of actually thinking maybe this person's getting a glass of water because they need a little bit of space and checking in. And mm-hmm. instead of kind of honoring that vulnerability and kind of pointing out the ways that people can change, and that that's a big part of the conversation that's missing, everyone in the room kind of jumped on him and saying, no, that's not consent. That's not consent. Silence isn't consent. And it turned into this very like passionate and almost angry, attacky conversation that was focused on a behavior that was hypothetical from the past. And mm-hmm. I thought that was such a miss, in that we do so often fail to give people space to say, wow, yeah, I've totally been in a place where I did something that hurt someone, or I've come so close to doing that. And mm-hmm. when we create that attack space where we're all like so revved up around proving what's right and saying how to do things, I feel mm-hmm. like we're just shutting people down, and that closes the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really resonate with you on that. And I've been in, you know, instances like that where I feel like I understand why this is happening. Like, we feel so strongly about this, and this is the world we're trying to build, you know, so passionately. And it's the only world we want to accept. The one where, you know, there are no gray zones. There is no silence. It's consent, not even implied, you know. But I'm looking for that balance so that we can be really, you know, kind of failingly human, and at the same time have, you know, really big ideals and aspirations.
That approach just feels good to me to hear, because I think you're right that we have this tendency to just other people instead mm-hmm. of talking about the behaviors, and how sometimes good people make mistakes mm-hmm. and sometimes good people misinterpret body language, because not all consent is verbal. And mm-hmm. And even just kind of going back to the conversation we had at the summit, how even in non-sexual situations, we're culturally trained to constantly push against people's boundaries and to convince them for that last drink, or to convince them to dance when they said no. And this kind of like social expectation around pressuring people to change their mind to make ourselves feel better, and not realizing how that behavior so easily translates into feeling like it's okay to do the same in the bedroom.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Totally.
What do you think is kind of the number one like question, or the main type of resistance that you experience when you're presenting around like consent and sexual communication?
Well, what I perceive to be the biggest challenge is the sort of a mixture of shame and embarrassment and a drastically different way of living life that sex educators are promoting. So it just seems so so far-fetched. Mm. It seems some of the ideas that, you know, so often I'll share something quite simple, you know, one of my favorite / least favorite things that happen in, you know, PG movies is how kisses happen. Mm-hmm. I remember a time in my life when I was a bit younger where it used to just feel very romantic when one actor would like force themselves on another until the other kind of submits or gets the point or finally arrives. Mm-hmm. And then it started getting less and less romantic and less of a turn on. And now most of these scenes actually just feel really yucky. Mm. But that was like a good 20-year journey for me. And I'm like invested in that journey. And so I feel like for a lot of folks, like I forget what it's like to be them. What is like to see those images and feel like that is actually a picture of sexual seduction I want for myself or I want to see happen to me. And so I feel like sometimes I'm selling a good or selling goods that people have not asked for.
Mm.
You know, so that's the biggest challenge. I feel like people are perceiving that I'm kind of from outer space where I say, you know, you just have to say, God, I would love to kiss you sometime, you know? And I get a lot of resonance back when I say, do you think I'm being ridiculous? And that's when I feel like I'm in alignment mm-hmm. with the room oftentimes. It's when I tell them that I know they might think that I'm being ridiculous. As opposed to insisting that, no, this is really the only way to do things, guys. You know, just check yourselves.
That's really interesting. And I love that you share that, that oftentimes what we're presenting feels like a total paradigm shift or really radical. Yeah. And because so many of us as sex educators have been really thinking about this and it's our lives for years and years and years.
Yes.
And we're coming to people who are on step one or just a few steps in and there it's kind of like, there's no way in hell I'd ever be okay doing that.
Yes. And why would I want to be?
Yeah.
You know, I forget sometimes that the sex educators to a lot of sort of public regular civic folk are hard to understand. Like, why are you like that? Why are you so out there? So I'm into this idea of like really honoring the journey that people have to make mm-hmm. in order to do the things we want them to do. And I would like for them to have some company in that journey as opposed to like just wave at them from really far and say like, you gotta be over here.
Being able to walk with someone and talk to them about the places where it's easy to get stuck or that can feel really bad. It can feel really hard to be here or even sharing like the ways that we ourselves have really messed up or the times we've felt really terrible or insecure so that it feels less isolating and it feels less dramatic. I think that's a really beautiful approach. I actually got into a Twitter fight a couple of days ago with a gentleman who was telling me that to convince someone to have sex with you is consent if ultimately they end up saying yes.
Right.
And we went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And I just kind of started realizing like he's trying, but he's not understanding the nuance. And I'm using this very like, absolutely not, you're wrong language. And so I started shifting it a little bit to soften it and using some examples. And we actually kind of came together a little bit in what we were saying. And in the end, he was like, okay, I'm starting to get what you're saying. Mm-hmm. But it was definitely one of those moments of realizing like he's doing the best with what he's been given. Mm-hmm. And now I'm asking him to do even more without a whole lot of information or space. Cause on Twitter, it's so limited.
Mm-hmm.
It just really like highlighted that for me.
That conversation that you just talked about, like I'm also thinking maybe it's already so explicit, it's not just implied that like he's not just arguing for, I mean, I wasn't part of this conversation. I don't know what conversation you're referring to, but like he's not just arguing for a philosophical consent concept, right? He's also talking about things he might have practiced his whole life.
Right.
You know, and so that's so hard to be like, okay, here I am. I'm going to talk to Dawn Sarah. And if she wins, then I'm a rapist.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard.
It is hard. Yeah. And I think that that's a place where we fail a lot as educators, as advice givers, as writers. I see so many really beautiful articles coming out of like very radical online spaces like The Body is Not an Apology or Everyday Feminism. But often those articles are really kind of saying, if you've done these things, you're one of the bad guys.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's a space where I feel like the internet really is failing, is giving space to say, you may have done these things in the past, but here's a better way. Let's all do better and heal together.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I think it's so important. I think I've mentioned on the podcast before, there have been a couple of times when I've definitely violated someone's consent. And like, in no way was it intentional. In no way was I trying to harm them. I just thought I was doing the right thing by like touching someone without asking, because we were kissing. And so the next thing you do is you touch someone after that. And then realizing afterwards, they were really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And like, that doesn't make me a bad person. It means that I had this learning moment and now I can look back and say, well, I don't ever want to feel like that again.
Yeah.
I know one of the other things that you do a lot of work around and talk around is rejection resilience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a space where a lot of the people who are listening today have a lot of interest and curiosity and how to cultivate that within themselves. I've talked about it some, but I would love to kind of roll around in that a little bit, in just for you, what rejection resilience means, and then how we can start kind of cultivating that in ourselves and making space for those feelings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great question. It's one of the things I love thinking about the most lately. And I think of it alongside resilience of all kinds, you know, in terms of stomaching all kinds of emotions. And rejection to me feels so basic that if I can't stomach that as a possible outcome, then I'm not going to do whatever could lead to that outcome, which might be to ask for consent, to seek something where there's an answer. To me, if a person is not able to accept or deal with a rejection, then that person likely wouldn't seek consent at all. And the whole point is moot, like regardless of how many scripts we give them and how much they understand the law. That emotionally it just becomes too huge a hurdle. So I'm really invested in working with people about rejection and how it feels. And so there's not a lot, I suppose, we can do as, you know, an educator or a speaker or even, you know, like a clinician working with someone to make someone like rejection. But I find, you know, the basic tools of emotional intelligence really help, you know, just naming it, so that for some people it actually becomes clarifying that, oh, that's rejection. I'm not actually angry. I'm feeling really rejected. I'm not feeling suddenly disengaged and disinterested, or I'm not suddenly in a rage. For no reason, I'm actually feeling rejected. And it's not easy to feel rejected. Mm-hmm. It's really not. I feel like socially, in many gender scripts, that there are just so many things available to us emotionally, socially, relationally, to prevent the feeling of rejection. And so often, the things that are mistaken for being rejection are actually disguises or masks for rejection. They're shielding us from actually feeling the rejection.
Yes. Oh, I think that's so powerful. The specifically around the disguise, I feel like that's where so often we get kind of the competition around, like, not being the person who texts first or not being invested if someone just disappears because we couldn't care. And these like personas that we put on that ultimately what they do is they completely shut us off from vulnerability and connection.
Yes. You know, and the word vulnerability is one that's embraced by, you know, a number of people, but I don't think in the wider circle that's a good word, that's a nice word, and certainly not rejection. And so there's just no ways to talk about feeling rejected without seeming like a loser, seeming like a failure, you know, and it's so much tied into masculine scripts specifically, but really to everyone's scripts.
I love exactly what you just said around the scripts and feeling like a loser, because I think that ties so much into a lot of the issues that we see around like consent and rape culture and just having these really like shallow connections is because if you reject me, that defines who I am as a person. And I can't risk that. And so instead, I'm going to do something where there's not even an option for you to reject me. Instead of seeing the rejection. I remember I was probably like 22 or 23. And my friend at the time was in his probably mid-30s. And I remember him telling me that when he goes to a gay bar to like pick up guys, he'll approach anyone who catches his eye, and he doesn't care if they say yes or no, because it's not about him if they reject him, and there's lots of other options that he has. And so if he's interested in someone, he expresses that interest. And if they say yes, great. And if they say no, great, nothing to do with me. And then he moves on and he has a great time no matter what. And he was trying to tell me, like, rejection has nothing to do with you and everything to do with the other person and their feelings that day or their biases or whatever. And that felt so, so completely foreign to my experience of rejection that I felt like there's no way I could ever feel that way about someone telling me no, because someone telling me no means I'm undesirable, I'm unlovable, I'm not wanted, which reinforces all the fears that I already have about the way that I look. And it was just, it was this conversation that for me is crystallized in my memory because I remember feeling like there's no way I'm ever going to be that kind of person. And I really feel like one of the reasons that he felt that way is because he had just been rejected so many times over the years and realized he's still okay. He gets yeses still too. And it was just kind of this practice of like, well, I've been rejected hundreds of times and I'm still happy and healthy and loved and I have all these great experiences. So I guess rejection doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. You're tapping into, you know, this evaluative, like this kind of, like basic value of a human being being presented for like evaluation in a, you know, when you're trying to seduce someone or invite them somewhere or ask them out or proposition them for something. And it's just so interesting to me because that is, you know, at least in this moment in the West, like that's often how sexual desirability is framed, is like, what are you? Are you a 10? Is he an 8?
Yeah.
You know, it's not about compatibility or like the relational status. It's not like what's it like between us? It's more like, what are you and how much do I make and what's the size of your boobs? And, you know, so that there are these like objective values that we assign. And I can't help but believe that all of these things, alongside this idea of like winners are good, losers are bad, is all part of our capitalist society. And I criticize capitalism and at the same time, you know, love it because it's fun in so many ways. But I do think it's part of the ideological framework that we live in.
I completely agree because So many of these values around, are you a 10? Are you an 8? How hot are you? Are you bikini ready? Are you ready to pick up guys on the beach? Those are all tied to, I can sell you a cream that makes your face look younger. I can sell you a bikini that's more flattering. I can sell you alcohol that makes you more appealing. And it really does tie back to, I mean, almost all of the messages that we have about what's desirable and sexy entirely come from marketing and Hollywood. I mean, our parents don't sit us down and say, here's how you decide what's desirable and here's how you figure out for yourself what sexy feels like. It's all put on us by marketing agencies and ads and glossy magazines and television shows. So I think you're completely right that all of this is tied together in kind of this like really fascinating, but simultaneously overwhelming and toxic mix that it's kind of fun to pull apart. But I find that sometimes when I start going down this rabbit hole, it starts to just feel like, holy crap, it's literally everything I've ever seen and been exposed to in my whole life.
Yeah.
You know, like upholds these things I'm trying to fight against and trying to overturn. And it's quite overwhelming, which I think ties back to why there's so many people who struggle with, you know, consent and sexual communication and rejection. Because when you start to really see that big picture, you're like, well, crap, it's everything. You were talking about how rejection resilience kind of goes with resilience of really anything. And I know some of the other things that you talk about is learning how to tolerate like fear and uncertainty and loss. And so often I get questions here on the show from people who want to tell a partner something or want to ask them something or want to understand something more about their experience or want to ask somebody out on a date, and they're asking me how to do it. And what I think they're actually asking is not how to say the thing, but how can I do the thing without feeling any of these icky feelings? And how can I say the thing in a way that I won't get rejected, I won't get broken up with, and I won't feel uncertain? And so I'd love to know what's some of the like work or just some of the ideas you have around how we can become more tolerant of these feelings that can actually be really, really icky when we have to sit with them for a while.
Well, you know, naming them is a really big one. And I think there's research, and, you know, never quote me on research because sometimes I make it up. But I believe there is research that shows that when you name how you're feeling, it transforms the feeling either sooner or more easily. But of course, name something not for the purpose of getting rid of it, just knowing that it helps to help it go wherever it needs to go. And then I actually do believe in practice. I went to a creativity conference recently called Mind Camp, which I love. And it's so stimulating because it's so connected to sexuality, except folks there call it creativity. And the practice of, you know, creative problem solving. And I ended up spending many hours in improv classes. And while I was there, I learned so much about what is hard to bear for me. And, you know, you and me were just talking about, you know, not being a loser or not being wrong or not feeling like a failure. You know, I actually felt like while I was in these improv classes, and they're not improv for comedy, they're just improv for, they might be words, they might be movements, they might be comedic, but they are also often tragic and sad, or, you know, all kinds of feelings come up. But the feelings that came up that were really hard to stomach include, you know, not being good, not being good at something, not being in control. There was one of the exercises was to pick a random word out of a bucket and then tell a story. And you have to start the moment you see the word and you go for a minute. And I love telling stories. So I'm invested in being good at storytelling, unlike, you know, just moving around, you know, like a monkey or something, that not as invested in being good at that. And there was a moment when I looked into the bucket and one of the pieces of paper was slightly open and I could spy the word. And it wasn't my turn yet. I was holding the bucket because I was next. And a part of me really thought about cheating and using that word and starting to think of my story before it was my turn to just get one more minute in there. And then, you know, I caught myself and thought, like, what are you doing here if not to practice feeling completely destabilized? And normalizing this feeling of destabilization. So I didn't cheat, and I picked something else. But the point is, I do believe that practice is the only way, like it's the only way I would make new pathways for how I react to my hot face, you know, when I'm embarrassed, when I'm feeling like I want to hide, when I have the impulse to lie or cheat so that I can look better or so that I can seem more competent than I might be. So I think we talked about this last time too on the summit, but this idea of practicing in controlled environments, I'm a big, big fan.
I love how you're talking about you're invested in being good at certain things. You know, because I think sometimes we look at ourselves and we see, well, I was totally okay with saying no to my friends last week, and I was super okay with saying no to my coworkers, so I must be really good at saying no, without realizing that you may be less invested in their opinions, or you may have more practice. And so I love how you were talking about you weren't so invested in acting out a monkey. It's okay to be a failure at that, because that's not a super important part of the things that you enjoy and who you are, but in storytelling, because you enjoy that, you want to make sure that you're good at it so you can reinforce that story about yourself.
Yes.
And I think that's such a powerful moment of self-awareness and being able to articulate that. And I kind of had this aha moment while you were talking of just like, wow, what am I really invested in that I'm not aware of? Because that's going to drive so much of my behavior and the fears that I have, the things that I avoid. And I think that that's so powerful. And I love that you're saying practice. Do you think there has to be a certain level of awareness that you are practicing in order to practice?
I think it makes it easier, but I don't think it's necessary, because I bet if I was just thrown into improv classes like throughout my adolescence, I would have reaped many of the rewards, you know, just some resilience around saying things that are not funny when I want to be funny, or, you know, looking not so elegant in my movements, you know. So I do think that it can just happen, but knowing makes it easier and makes it more effective. So it's a good time-saving device.
Yeah.
And you know, the other thing about the practice that I was interested in practicing, you know, making quote-unquote mistakes. I was not particularly interested in practicing stomaching other people's guilt and other people's shame, you know, but I saw a lot of that. I saw other people messing up and them sort of crushing themselves a little bit, and going through their own motions of dealing with feeling like a failure, feeling like, oh my God, I'm the person who does not belong in this class. Everyone else is good. I suck. Mm-hmm. You know, I wasn't there for that. I ended up witnessing a lot of it. I felt myself, compelled in different moments sometimes to say, no, you're amazing, just so you know. Like, I wanted to pick them up. And other times, witnessing someone else being ashamed brought up something in me that made me want to, like, get away from them. Mm-hmm. You know, I found them shameful too, you know. So I wasn't quite ready to do that work, and I wasn't really that interested, but it happened to me anyway. So I feel like it kind of happens even without conscious, like, studious effort.
Yeah. As you're talking, I'm starting to get this. The advice that I so often give to people, both on the blog and on the podcast, who write in wanting to make some, like, huge disclosure or mm-hmm. ask their partner something really scary is I usually tell them, like, back up a couple of steps and get better at just talking about things when it's easy and fun, when you're not in the bedroom, or asking questions and being genuinely curious, to build a foundation where it feels safe to have these conversations where you're not super emotionally vulnerable and super emotionally invested in the outcome, so that when you get to that stage, then it's much easier because you've built up practice and resilience and you know how to make that container. And it's really, it occurs to me as you're talking that in doing that, I'm inviting people to practice these uncomfortable things, but in low stakes or more controlled environments, like you said. But also there is the conscious person who's going to be consciously cultivating these spaces. And then the person who may not really be aware that they're practicing the partner because they weren't part of that conversation, and how it's still going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the two of them are still going to have these conversations where one person might be consciously saying, okay, tonight I want to ask these fun questions. And then the partner just kind of plays along. But in the end game, both of them are more skilled and have more information and now have this new memory together.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's, yeah. Oh my gosh, you're giving me so many aha moments about myself.
You're so awesome. One of the things I wanted to jump in on when you were saying, like, you're wondering what your things are, like the things you're invested in, your stories. One of my favorite versions of would you rather to play is, would you rather be misunderstood for being, let's say, the question I would ask you, Dawn, would be like, would you rather be misunderstood for being unkind or uninsightful?
Oh, as soon as you said uninsightful, I was like, that one. That felt worse.
You know, so we could go for hours, and I would. I would love to do that with you one day, just to like keep going on, like, how do you not want to be perceived? What are the things about you that you would hate to be thought of as? And I think seeing is misunderstood, like, make you, like, you don't have to then explain yourself and say, but because I'm actually, you know, really kind. So it allows us to play longer.
Okay. We're going to have to make a date to do that, because yes. That game sounds so like squeaky and vulnerable and icky, and I love it. I want to like find all those little places where I'm like, ooh, that feels weird. Ooh, I don't know if I like that. And yeah. Like get all those little insights. Oh my gosh, I love that. I hope our listeners play this game. I'm like, but I also think I'm a little weird in that, like, I kind of love feeling really awfully vulnerable. And like, when I get that stomach turny, like, oh shit, should I be doing this? I'm like, I love being here.
I do think it's a kind of high.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes like really, it's really self-fulfilling. It's great. Like, mm-hmm. if you can get high from becoming more honest with yourself, then you're actually doing it for less effort than it would cost most people.
Yes. And, you know, I also think that one of the really powerful things about, like, I try to display my own vulnerability often, either through my blog posts where I share places where things hurt really badly, or even on the podcast when I talk about, like, well, that didn't go the way that I thought it would, is I feel like because we don't have very many places where we see, like, real honest vulnerability, that showing it is so important when we have the opportunity to do that. And I think that's true in our relationships too. Going back to kind of the disguises that you were talking about, so many of the things that I see happening in relationships is people wanting to connect with the person that they're with, but not having to feel vulnerable about it, and not like they want the reward without having to take the risk or take the leap. Mm-hmm. And trying to demonstrate over and over and over again to people, like, one of you has to be the one with the courage that says, all right, here I am. Here's the scary stuff. Here's the thing I don't want to show you. And then that grants permission to the other person to say, wow, well, they just showed me that. I guess I can show them my scary bits, my soft parts. And you can't have that softness without one of you having the courage to go first.
Yes. And that's actually one of the things, I mean, you and I only know each other professionally, but, you know, one of the things I love the most about you is from the very first contact that we had over email, I can sense all of that, that you're willing to take the first step. You're willing to be the first, you know, to put your hand out. And all I had to do was reach halfway, you know? So I feel like those things are so rewarding. Once you, like, the positive feedback loop is just so strong. So, you know, the first step in taking the first step might be actually the hardest.
I agree.
Ever.
Yep. I totally agree with that. I think that the very first time we try something or we go to do something, we kind of inherently know we're not going to be very good at it. Because so many of the things that we do in our lives are a skill. And the first time we try any, I mean, if I were to sit down at the piano right now and try and make something beautiful come out of it, like, you'd get some shitty chopsticks. I mean, that's like it. But when I sit down to do it, I know that. Like, I know I'm not going to be like doing a Beethoven symphony on the piano that sounds beautiful. But then we expect ourselves to be experts the first time we go to talk about sex, or the first time we're trying to make a relationship work, when we've never actually practiced those skills and made ourselves vulnerable in that way. And like, that first time is always like, oh, I could die. It feels that drastic, or it feels that horrible. And then when you survive it and you're like, wow, it wasn't that bad, and you do it again, and then you do it again, and now it's just, it feels normal after a while.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, that's such good stuff. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Like, I just literally want to like drive to Toronto right now and get some tea and just like sit with you and talk for like 12 hours.
Let's do that. Okay. I'll meet you halfway.
Okay. That's perfect. okay. Well, we have like maybe 10 minutes left. And so I'd love to know, would you rather... Different version. Would you rather talk about like empathy and emotional intelligence, or would you like to help me answer a listener question that's about communicating vulnerably around sex?
Questions.
Yay.
No idea what they are.
Okay, perfect. Well, we can kind of like fumble through it together, because it's a really, really sweet question. And I just, when I read it, I was like, oh, I think BK would be great at this one. So let's see. So we got an email from Natalie. And it says, hello, Dawn. I love your podcast. I recently found it and I have listened to almost all of them. You're really easy to listen to and you give great advice. I'm a married 23-year-old lesbian. My partner and I have been married for almost 3 years. It has been amazing being married to my best friend. My question is that my partner and I have a pretty good sex life, but we don't communicate very well during sex, so I never know what she likes or not. We like to watch lesbian porn together, but I also watch straight and other kinds of porn by myself, and she doesn't know that. We recently bought a magic wand, and I love it, but I orgasm really fast, and my wife doesn't get a chance to come because she's too worried about pleasing me. So I guess I'm just asking for help on how to communicate and how to approach certain conversations. Thanks, Natalie. I love this question, because... I love that they're married and she's talking about being married to her best friend and they have this great relationship. And they just kind of seem to be stuck in not being able to really talk about their experiences. And so I'd love to know, kind of, where do you think is a good jumping off point for Natalie if she wants to get better at communicating during sex, but also it sounds like she's feeling some guilt around orgasming and her wife isn't, because she's giving. So kind of like, what are the first things that pop up for you on this one?
Well, I don't know if this is my final answer, but the first thing that popped up was just talking about sex, not about sexual experience with each other. And I like to detour a lot in life. And so including in conversations, and I'm not sure what's happening for both people, and I don't know what their sexual histories are, and I don't know how comfortable they talk about sexuality, period. So I wouldn't look right in the bullseye and say, how do you talk about sexual experience between these two people? But I would ask questions like, when was the first time you ever saw a naked person that wasn't yourself? Or, you know, so things that are close to nothing at all, so that the rapport builds and that it's like easing into more scary territory. And so in those conversations, hopefully things also come up like, oh, my parents would kill me if they even know that I saw their videotapes. Mm-hmm. And then we can get into a little bit more of, oh, okay, so I didn't talk about this. I never talked about it. I've had other partners and we don't talk. So I'm more into talking about other things. What would you say?
That's actually exactly what I was going to suggest that they start with. Of too often when we try to talk about sex, we have this habit of dictating our experiences and assuming the other person's experience and then feel like we've had a conversation. And instead, I think it's so powerful to get really good at asking questions and just absorbing this other person's world and experience and the language they use to describe certain things, and like genuinely just being curious without any expectations, because I feel like that's how you get some really, really powerful information mm-hmm. out of people that can then help you have better conversations the next time and the next time. And so I love like taking a few steps back and let's just practice asking each other fun questions about sex. And I think fun is another place where it's easy to forget, like, this is all supposed to be stuff that we enjoy. Mm-hmm. And it can be a really fun, playful way to connect with someone and ourselves and our pleasure and delight in our bodies. And when we feel like we're not doing something well, because culturally, I think we tie so much importance to being great in bed, mm-hmm. that it's easy to be like, well, now we have to talk about the sex. And it's kind of got this weight behind it, instead of like, how can we talk about sex in a new way? And what are things I've never asked you? What's something that you wish I would ask you about? And turning it into something that's like fun and playful and easy. And not to say that there aren't going to be moments that aren't serious or painful, but approaching it, I think, from a place of like playfulness and lightness gives you so much more opportunity to also be open and not defensive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm with you. Mm-hmm.
The other thing that kind of jumped out at me was, you know, I orgasm really fast and my wife doesn't get a chance to come because she's too worried about pleasing me. Mm-hmm. I'm really curious about that because there seems to be this assumption that there's something wrong mm-hmm. with, I have a lot of orgasms and my wife gives me lots of pleasure and she doesn't get a chance to come. And like, is that actually a problem? Maybe mm-hmm. that's exactly what your wife wants out of your sexual connection right now. Mm-hmm. And can we make space for that instead of the story you're telling yourself? What's the actual story and how can you get more information from your wife about how she feels about it all? You know, but I think that comes once you get a little bit more comfortable just talking sex instead of your actual, like you said, the actual sexual experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say that exact same thing too. And also, I mean, it's interesting that there is some assumption that we know exactly what we want and that we want, like that is pretty clear. I mean, I can really relate to that kind of sexual experience where giving pleasure is very safe and secure and it's so pleasurable. But receiving it or switching roles might put me in a very unfamiliar place and I'm not sure if I even want that. And so I'm into these conversations where, you know, partners can talk about like, what do you want? Is it actually good for you? I'm making some assumptions. I might be wrong. to share all of that. And also, I'm into people pushing each other a little, mm-hmm. you know, when you get to that point that it feels comfortable enough to talk about these things, to actually say, what would happen if, I gave you pleasure and you weren't allowed, you know, not just for something different to happen between the two people, but also, instead of seeing sex as the thing to enjoy, but seeing it as actually then a vehicle for these two people to start moving each other in a deep way.
So glad you said that. I have a profile on FetLife, and one of the things that's in my profile is my fetish is intimacy and seeing how deep I can go with people. And to me, that's one of the powerful things about having true vulnerability and intimacy with someone, you know, and it doesn't even have to be a sexual relationship or a romantic relationship. Like, I do this with my friends too, of just when you get to a place where you can truly open yourself up and really share the scary stuff, you can start pushing each other and you can start exploring edges and kind of tiptoeing into those places where it's like, oh, this doesn't feel so safe, but I'm with someone that I trust and who has my back. So maybe it's okay for me to question myself. Yeah. Maybe it's okay for me to do this thing that I always felt a lot of shame around. And that to me is where there's so much like juicy, meaty growth. And like, that's the like, life-changing kind of memory stuff that you get of looking back and being like, that was the first time I did that thing I never thought I would do. And it's because you invited me to do it and I felt safe. Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that so much. That just like made all my hair stand up. Yes. Yeah. But you're right. Like it takes being able to talk, being able to share, feeling safe, going places that don't feel safe.
Yes.
And yes. Like, that's the power of creating a relationship like this of, you know, if you've married your best friend and you have this wonderful relationship, then start mm-hmm. cultivating that depth and start kind of nudging at each other. Like, what if you weren't allowed to touch me all night long and I was just going to touch you? Like, what would that feel like? And being okay with mm-hmm. being like, oh God, that feels so uncomfortable.
Yeah. I love how you put that, being feeling safe to go to places that aren't safe.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That felt so good. Well, I hope, Natalie, that got you at least a jumping off point for exploring new ways to communicate with your wife about sex. I think that BK's advice of just starting with questions about sex and making it part of your daily conversations and your regular, you know, date nights and when you two are just chatting will help create that foundation that you can build on to then start sharing the more personal stuff and asking the more personal questions. And also like exploring each other's experiences and assumptions. I think that that's a really powerful, powerful place to be. Okay, so we're right at the hour, and I want to know, do you want to go for a few more minutes and answer one more question, or do you need to wrap up?
I have time for you, absolutely.
Yay! Okay, I got this question from a listener named Lindsay, and she sent a jumble of questions, a whole bunch of them, and so I've been answering them kind of piecemeal as I have different guests on, and this one I thought was a really interesting question, and it's about rape fantasies. So okay. would you be willing to roll around in this a little bit with me?
Yeah.
Okay. So Lindsay says, the second question that I have is a little more difficult for me to articulate. I don't want to sound offensive, and I'm genuinely curious. You've talked a few times on the show about sadism and rape play, and you even had a sadism expert on the show who was Frozen Merceau. And she says, I guess I'm still struggling with how these acts are intimate. I can see rape play being empowering for someone who has been raped to now be the rapist in their fantasies or scenes. But how is it helpful or arousing if the reverse is true, a rape survivor being raped again in their fantasy? I also struggle with what causes someone to enjoy or be aroused by seeing someone else in pain or crying. These may be difficult questions to answer, but I'm really trying to understand. Honestly, partially because I occasionally have rape-ish fantasies, even though I'm terrified of rape in real life, and I struggle with why I think of that.
Mm.
So
what a great question.
I know, I agree. Like, I love the vulnerability in this question, and I love that, Lindsay, I love that you're asking a question that both scares you and makes you uncomfortable, but you still also have this curiosity around it. That's an attitude that really resonates with me. What are kind of your initial thoughts as we dig into this?
I have so many.
Yeah, no, me too.
I'll pick one. And that is that I think rape and sexual violence is so prevalent in everyday, and we witness it, we watch it in movies, that it affects all of us, even folks who are not survivors. So I feel like what healing and what pleasure and what transformation that's available to go through rape play is actually there for everyone who might have experienced these kinds of violences directly, indirectly, or just somewhere in between. And that the healing and the good things that come out of it is to be able to be in control and recontextualize something that is so intense, so stimulating in that way that it stimulates all of our senses. It triggers all kinds of responses within the psyche, within our spirit, within our bodies, and do it on our own terms. I think that's you know, puzzle piece number one.
Yeah.
What are you thinking, Dawn?
Well, I have two thoughts on that. The first is I really resonate with what you just said about getting to kind of retell the story as a rape survivor. There is something for me very empowering about choosing to give my power away and being able to play that out with someone that I trust. And it's this retelling of what it means to have either my power taken away or giving my power away. And so I really love this perspective that you're offering around healing. The other thing that kind of came to mind was I recently talked to Princess Callie, who is a massive BDSM expert. And one of the things that she said is there's a difference between a rape fantasy and a ravishment fantasy. And often what we're actually talking about when someone has a rape fantasy is actually a ravishment fantasy of the fantasy is someone wants you so much that they can't be held back by this need, and they just want to consume you and savor you and enjoy you and just kind of like overpower you with this need versus an act of violence, which is more a rape fantasy where, you know, in the fantasy, perhaps you're actually being injured and hurt and scared. And so there's energetically a difference. And, you know, if we were to get really kind of intellectual about it, you know, a ravishment certainly is a consent violation by all means in so many ways, but energetically it feels different to me. And so I think one question is to Lindsay, like these rapish fantasies that you have, are the fantasies really about violence and pain? Since she is also asking questions about sadism, I think there's a possibility of that. Or are these fantasies about someone just being so overtaken with your desirability and your beauty and your enticing self that they just like can't hold themselves back? So I think there's some nuance there to dig into.
And I can see how both of those, you know, hold beautiful possibilities for the experiences of both.
Yeah.
Might be interesting to different people.
Yeah, and to me, one of the powerful things about fantasies that are taboo is that we are giving ourselves an opportunity to play in spaces that help us to learn things about ourselves, that help us to kind of stretch our understanding of our own pleasure and our own experiences. And I think that's one of the powerful things about fantasies, is there's a vast difference to me about fantasizing about being raped and or ravished and actually being raped. In that my fantasy gets to play out however I want it to, as violent, as cruel, as mean, or as loving and sensual as it does. It's me controlling the dialogue and the experience. And so I'm still coming from a place of power, even if in the fantasy itself, I have none. And that's, to me, I think, a really important aspect of honoring and not shaming ourselves for exploring some of these taboos.
I had a some clients recently who, a man and a woman, both cis folks, who were entering into these experimentations where they were exchanging power, and both of them are very feminist and lefty and progressive in thought. And so they were actually having a lot of struggle when they switch back and forth, and when the man has the power. When the woman has the power, they felt both quite comfortable because it felt like an expressed a manifestation of their politics. That's how they want to write the world. You know, it's a almost like in response to patriarchy, that they felt safe to play that way. But when it switched and the man had the power, both of them became quite uncomfortable, although very aroused. And so it makes me think of Lindsay's question, because so many of these experiences and pleasures are so mixed with the intellectual understanding of the world, that all the meanings come in when they don't necessarily have to.
It makes so much sense to me that, you know, intellectually, we love putting the woman in power and kind of flipping this like masculine patriarchy system that we're in. Like, from an intellectual standpoint, that feels good that we're having sex that way. But then, you know, as feminists, have this couple where when the man has power, to feel bad about it, but also to be very aroused. I think that just beautifully captures how so many of us feel about fantasies that really push at the edges of what we feel like is right.
Yeah. And I have to agree with you that, you know, so taboos are not, they're the opposites of what we should stay away from. They're the places we want to go, right? That's where desire can be very rich. And not all taboos are exciting to all people, but the taboos that excite you are, they're exciting because they're so meaningful. They hold some kind of importance in your psyche. So I'm really into this idea of giving people permission to look, not just to enjoy, and not just to feel like they have permission, but like there's so much to harvest there to know about yourself. You know, it's so important to me. I fight for, you know, human rights on a daily basis. And that's why what looks like the violation of rights holds so much weight, so much meaning for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's such good stuff. I want to touch really quickly too on her question about sadism. She said, I'm still struggling with how these acts are intimate, and I struggle with what causes someone to enjoy or be aroused seeing someone in pain or crying. And so in my experience, which is not vast, I don't consider myself like super sadistic, maybe a little sadistic, depending on the situation. But I've had folks who are, I really identify as sadists, talk to me about this. And one of the things that I've heard again and again is that there is so much trust and vulnerability required in a space with someone for them to truly reveal to you what most humiliates them, what most scares them, what would be most painful. And so from the person who is doing these things to the other person, you're kind of holding this very, very sacred space of this person is being so vulnerable with me, and I get to play in this space that's so delicate and could be so damaging. And there's a tremendous amount of power and intimacy in that exchange. You know, I know that something else that Princess Callie said is you can't humiliate someone over something that they don't find humiliating. And I'm not going to share my most humiliating fears and experiences with just anybody. I have to really deeply trust someone before I say, this is what makes me feel most exposed. And then to let someone poke at me in those ways, for me at least, I feel like that requires a great deal of intimacy. I'm not going to just let anybody do that to me. And so I think at least from my experience, that's one way that sadism and sadistic play can be very arousing, of just realizing like how much someone's letting you see and how much power they're giving to you and like what that feels like.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting from my experience, this is reminding me of playing taiko, the big Japanese drums that I played for many years. And they're very loud, and it looks very, very powerful. And when we do workshops, often with groups of women, many women will refuse to do certain exercises because they say that they don't need to be violent. They have no interest in being violent and being showing aggression. And what that highlighted for me was the conflation of power, the conflation of, you know, the expression of power with malice, with truly harming someone, of the true sense of violence, where we are injuring someone in whatever way. Whereas these power exchanges that might look violent, that might, you know, have pain involved, they're not actually violent. They're not the definition of hurting someone against their will. So that's the main difference. I can see why watching someone cry or be in pain, aside from knowing that it's good for them or that they're asking for it or that they're into it and they're healing, you know, all those good things, that the surge of power itself is very pleasurable, and it doesn't have to be a bad thing. To be very, very powerful and to overpower someone has been given a really bad rap, actually. But it's just as pleasurable as giving up power and surrendering. I think these are the ranges of human pleasures.
And something else that kind of occurred to me as I was listening to you talk is, I know there are sadists out there who actively giggle and delight in making someone cry. But when we dig underneath that, I think often what we find is for the person who is crying, they really want this experience. They want to find some way to release these tears or to be embodied, and they are up in their head all of the time. And so they seek out these experiences or these exchanges where they know they're going to be made to cry in some way. And they want that for themselves because they get a high from it, or because afterwards they feel this immense sense of relief, or because in some way it's tied to their pleasure. And because they want it so much, the person making them cry gets to delight in, like, I'm giving you this thing, even though you say you hate it, I know you really want it.
Yeah.
You know, and kind of making that into a game. So it can look very mean. Both of them are getting what they want. Well, I hope, Lindsay, that gave you some new ways to think about rape fantasies and sadism and your own experience with your fantasies. And if you have any other questions, feel free to write back. But I had a lot of fun rolling around in that with you, BK.
Likewise.
We are now deliciously past our hour, and so I would love for you to first share with our listeners how they can find you online and stay in touch and see what you're up to.
Cool. I'm at Karen B. K. Chan, so that's my Twitter handle, and I'm also at KarenBKChan.com, and I stopped givingoutfluidexchange.org as much, because I'm doing more and more emotional work, and a lot of people don't see the connection, but they're both going to the same place.
That's really interesting. People don't really see the connection. That's all I see, but okay. Well, I will have links to your website and your Twitter on sexgetsreal.com. So for anyone who's interested, it's a nice easy click from the podcast website. And I just want to thank you so much, BK, for coming on the show and rolling around in all of these amazing topics with me. And I feel so like enriched from this conversation with you. So thank you.
You're so welcome. And thank you, Dawn. You're one of my favorites. I love talking to you anytime.
Yay. Well, I would love to have you back at some point in the next couple of months to help me field even more questions and to see what you're up to, if you're up for it.
Let's do it.
Okay. Well, to everybody who's listening, thank you so much for joining in. If you have any questions yourself that you want me to field, or if you have any comments or stories you want to share, just go to sexgetsreal.com. There's a place where you can send me a note. You can also find all of the links from this episode there. And I just want to thank you so much for listening. Until next time, this is Dawn Sarah with Sex Gets Real.